On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Permeable Reactive Barriers, Lessons Learned and New Directions. Today's training was developed by ITRC's PRB team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm serve as your moderator today. I'm going to cover some introductory material and then turn over the presentation to our instructors from the PRB team. As we go through the training today, you are in control of which slide you're on. The upper left-hand corner has the slide numbers, and the instructors will say the slide number as we go through today. If you're using the Cluvin system, the series of orange buttons along the top allow you to navigate through the presentation. The double left button takes you back to the first slide in the presentation. The single left button takes you back one slide. Most often you'll be using that third button, the single right arrow key, that moves you forward one slide at a time through the presentation. If you're using a Cluvin system, you'll also see a series of slide numbers along the left, and that can allow you to jump quickly from one slide to another. The house button, the orange button along the top, takes you back to the presentation overview page we were at today. And the question mark button is there primarily for a simulcast audience. Our simulcast audience is joining us today and hearing the audio through their computer speakers. They're unable to ask questions out loud during the designated question answer periods. So the question mark button allows them to type in a question that I will ask during the Q&A periods. Anyone is welcome to use this button at any time during today's presentation. If you're on the phone line, you're welcome to ask your own questions, but we do ask that you wait until the designated question and answer breaks. We'll have one about in the middle of today's presentation and another at the end. Today's training course is based on the document ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance on Permeable Reactive Barriers, Lessons Learned, and New Direction. The document is available to download at the end of today's training. We also have the presentation itself available to download. In addition to the information shown on the slides, there's a speaker notes section that has additional details. In today's presentation, we're going to talk about Permeable Reactive Barriers, or PRBs. A PRB is a continuous in-situ permeable treatment zone designed to intercept and remediate a contaminant plume. Over the past 10 years, the use of iron-based PRBs has evolved from innovative to accepted standard practice. Reactive media such as compost, limestone, granular activated carbon, and zeolites have also been deployed in recent years. Research and deployment of biobarrier systems is also growing. Today's training presents updated information regarding new developments, innovative approaches, and lessons learned in the application of PRBs. The information will be presented by reviewing approaches and results at several sites where PRBs have been deployed. Moving to slide two, I'm going to tell you a little bit about ITRC. ITRC's goal is to help people make better decisions, and we do this through a network led by state regulators and including others in the environmental community. This network works together to form technical teams to address a specific topic area, and those teams create documents and training. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States and includes numbers as shown on the state map on this slide. Federal partners include Departments of Energy and Defense and the Environmental Protection Agency. And a special thanks to EPA, who is co-sponsoring today's training by providing the Cluvin site. For more information about ITRC, please visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. On slide three, we offer several different internet-based training classes. So along the left are listed courses that trainings that are developed and that we're currently offering this year. We're also working to develop new courses, as listed on the right of this slide. For more information about ITRC's courses, please visit the ITRC website under Internet-Based Training. I'd also like to tell you about our archives. We have copies of previous courses available for you to listen to at your convenience. And in fact, some are even available for you to download and take with you. That information about the archives is available from the ITRC website under Internet-Based Training, or you can go directly using the link shown at the bottom of this slide. On slide four, for those of you who joined the call after I got started, please review the logistical reminders along the left-hand side of this slide. On the right, in today's presentation, we're going to start by talking about hydraulic issues and performance issues. we'll talk about an iron and zeolite case studies. About halfway through, we have a break for questions, and we ask that you hold your questions until that designated question answer break. In the second half, we'll come back and talk about a biobarrier case study and a compost wall case study. At the end, we'll go through some links to additional resources and also show you the feedback form. We ask that you provide your feedback before leaving the site today. At the end, we have more time for your questions. On slide 5, I'll introduce our first two instructors. All of our instructors are members of the ITRC Permeable Reactive Barriers team. Mike Duchesne is a senior engineer at Environmental Technologies in Waterloo, Ontario. He assists clients in the detailed designs of PRBs, including assessments of groundwater hydraulics, assessment and specification of potential construction techniques, and construction QA/QC protocols. Scott Warner is a vice president and principal hydrogeologist at Geomatrix in Oakland, California. His practice has evolved from designing and performing hydrogeological characterization and analysis to designing, implementing, and consulting on innovative in-situ groundwater remediation technologies. On slide 6, our second two instructors today are Alec Nuggle, who is an engineering geologist in the Groundwater Protection Division at the California Regional Water Quality Control Board. He oversees solvent and petroleum hydrocarbon cleanups at waste and waste disposal activities at industrial facilities and landfills. David Smith is with the University of Waterloo in Ontario. He is a research hydrogeologist working on a wide range of projects related to the in-situ remediation of metals and inorganic contaminants in groundwater using permeable reactive barriers. On slide 7, it is my pleasure to turn over today's training to Mike Duchesne from Environmental Technologies. Mike?
Great. Thanks, Juliana. And I'm just going to recap a bit what Juliana did. And over the next 2 and a bit hours, we're going to take you through a bunch of details on permeable reactive barriers. I'm going to start off with some general performance of PRBs over the last 10 years or so. And then we're going to go into 4 specific case studies. Scott Warner will talk about an iron PRB, and it happens to be the first iron PRB that went in back in 1994-95. And then he'll also talk about a sorption barrier that's used to treat radionuclides. Alec will talk about a biobarrier that was installed in California for treatment of VOCs. And then Dave Smith will finish up with a solid organic carbon barrier for treatment of acid mine drainage. So moving to slide number 8. So just a bit of history on PRBs and the ITRC PRB team. The first field research PRB went in CFB Borden back about 15 years ago. And then, like I said, the first commercial full-scale PRB went in 94-95, and Scott will talk about that one shortly. And PRBs, as Juliana mentioned, has really evolved from an innovative practice to what is a standard accepted practice. So back in 96, the ITRC PRB team has formed, and over the last 10 years or so, they've produced 4 ITRC documents, and the latest one being PRB 4, Lessons Learned, New Directions, and that's what this course is based upon. And all of those 4 documents are available through the ITRC website. And the ITRC team also worked with the DOD, the DOE, and the EPA to produce 2 additional guidance documents. And back in 99-2000, they put together a classroom training session. So the ITRC again worked with the EPA and delivered this classroom training session to 14 cities throughout the United States. And then lastly, we've done 3 internet-based training courses, and this is the 3rd course. And as Juliana mentioned, the other 2 courses are archived, and you can get those through the CLUIN website. So moving to slide number 9. Just to recap a definition of a PRB, most of you probably know what a PRB is or probably worked with them, but really it's just a continuous in-situ treatment zone, and the idea here is to cut off a plume at a property boundary or before the plume moves into a water body or some other off-site impacts, and it can be created either using materials that are reactive, and one of the most common ones is using granular iron or Zilveran iron for treatment of chlorinated solvents, so the material itself is reactive, or the material can stimulate a biological reaction that then in turn treats your contaminants. So So moving to slide number 10. So this is an abbreviated table of some of the treatment materials that have been used in PRBs, and there's a more detailed table in table 2.2 in that PRB document. So the one that's been used the most, about 130 sites, full and pilot scale, has been use of zero-valent iron for treatment of chlorinated solvents. And also zero-valent iron is effective at treating or precipitating reducible metals such as chrome-6 and arsenic. Basic oxygen furnace slag has been used in the field, and numerous lab studies have been done with that to show treatment of arsenic and phosphorus with that material. And then solid organic amendments. So the next three, the solid organic amendments, liquid organic amendments, and gas amendments, they're all to provide food for biological reactions. Specifically, the solid organic amendments, such as wood chips and leaf composts, have been used to treat acetamine drainage, and that's what Dave Smith will talk more detail on. It's also effective in treating nitrate, and basically any compounds that are biologically degradable can be treated with a solid organic amendment to promote biological degradation of the compounds. Similarly, liquid organic amendments can be used, and there's some differences between those two, which Alec and Dave will cover. And gas amendments can be used. Probably the most common one would be used oxygen, like an oxygen sparge wall, to treat biological degradable compounds. Both zeolites and phosphates are absorptive-type materials that will treat different metals. Moving to slide number 11. This is just showing where the iron PRBs for VOC treatment have been installed. And there's about 98, I think now there's up around 100 full and pilot scale systems out there that are operating. And quite a few systems. At ETI, we looked at that and we said, well, you know, there's 100 out there, how are they all working? So ETI has been involved with these to some extent in all 100 of these PRBs that have gone in. So we went back to our files and the data that we do have and did a somewhat of a subjective analysis. Some of the sites we've seen data, we've got current data, we know that they're working, there's some issues. Some sites we saw data for a while and then we haven't heard back from the site owners, so we assume no news is good news. And lastly, some of them we don't hear anything at all and we assume no news is good news. So it's somewhat of an objective analysis, but anyways, of those 100 sites, only about 55 had been in the ground long enough to get any sort of meaningful results. And of those 55, we found that 48 of them were working as intended, or they're meeting their goals, their treatment goals. And of the 7 that weren't meeting them, 3 had hydraulic issues, and at 3 of the sites, they had implemented pump and treat to either supplement or replace the PRB. 2 have hydraulic issues that are still under evaluation, so those are incomplete plume capture, so nothing has happened at those sites. They're still trying to decide a course of action. And 2 sites are not treating due to insufficient residence time due to some hydraulic issues, and that those 2 sites, again, they're still under evaluation and no work has been taken. So, again, somewhat of a subjective analysis, but nonetheless, it does show that, by far, most of these PRBs that are properly designed are working correctly. So move to slide 12. Talk about performance assessment. And this has gone through a bit more in section 5 of the PRB 4 document. But in general, there's 4 types of assessments. Obviously, the main one is the chemical assessment. You know, the PRB is installed to treat some compounds down to some levels, and the chemical assessment is obvious. The other 3 assessment of the hydraulics, the geochemistry, and the microbial aspects of the PRB are important to look at for how the PRB is operating today, and also to extrapolate in the future how the PRB is operating. And I'll talk a bit about that in future in a few minutes. And obviously, all these assessments are interdependent. If you have hydraulic issues and the flow is not getting through your PRB, then you're not going to meet your chemical goals. So it's quite obvious that that they're all interdependent. And I'm going to go through some examples, and basically because of my background, I'm going to more focus on use granular iron PRBs for VOC treatment, but obviously the assessments that are done for these types of PRBs can be applied to other types of reactive materials for treatment of other compounds. So turning to slide 13, this is a bit of a recap from our last internet course, but the monitoring programs that are typically implemented for PRBs are as far as the regulators go, they're most interested in what's coming out of the PRB, shown by the red wells. So we have a set of wells down gradient to monitor the, what's coming out of the PRB, and also at each end of the PRB to show that we're not missing any of the plume that's going around the end of the PRB, or that the PRB is not causing the plume to divert around the ends of the walls. The yellow wells show are usually installed for performance monitoring, and they're to basically know what's coming into the PRB, what's happening within the PRB, so you can make some performance assessments based on those, the data from those wells. So turning to slide 14, one concept that needs to be kept in mind, because almost all PRBs, I don't know of any PRB that has been installed that has not been installed across a contaminant plume. Usually by the time it comes around to doing remediation, the plume is already off-site or is already impacting a water body. So the PRB is put in to cut off the plume, which leaves a portion of the plume down gradient. So as the PRB treats the water, you're going to have clean water coming out of the back end of the PRB, but then due to contamination, residual contamination in the aquifer, desorption from the aquifer sediments and from some low K lenses, it's going to take some time for that groundwater, as it moves between the PRB and the well, it'll get recontaminated until that aquifer material between those two zones gets cleaned up. So there's some time for flushing required, and it's going to vary depending on the groundwater flow velocity, the types of soils, the fraction of organic organic carbon within the aquifer. And so it's really hard to say. We've seen results anywhere from 6 months where the downgradient well cleans up to, with some sites, there's 5 years or so because the groundwater flow velocity is so slow. So it makes somewhat of a challenge for assessment, but knowing that that's going to occur, it makes your assessment a lot easier. Turn to slide 15. The hydraulic performance basically talks about, you know, the idea is to design the PRB so you have minimal impact on the hydraulics of the groundwater flow system. But what happens is invariably in some of these cases, like I mentioned before, those seven sites that weren't working as we expected them, most of the time it's hydraulic issues that have come up, and could come from sewer lines influencing the flow field, and most of the time it's not actually the sewer line itself, but it's the high permeable bedding that's placed beneath the sewer line that creates a conduit for flow and can cause changes in flow around the PRB. And then there's construction artifacts such as smearing or improper backfilling procedures that cause construction problems for the flow. So a couple things can happen. You can divert the plume around the PRB and not get treatment, or you can divert part of it around and only get partial treatment, or if the hydraulics are designed so that it's not enough residence time, you could get insufficient treatment due to the insufficient residence time. So moving to slide 16, characterization, it can't be stressed. I think every course we talk about this, you really get one shot at designing and installing these PRBs. Most of them are excavated in. It's a large construction project to put in a PRB. So to come back and add 10 feet onto an end of a PRB is a very expensive proposition. It's not like a pump and treat system where you can add another well or increase the flow rate from one well to tweak your capture. Really need to know exactly what's going on before you put in the PRB, and you really have one chance at site characterization beforehand. Some of the issues that have happened in the past is incomplete plume capture. The PRB is put in and then put in several more wells afterwards to monitor the PRB and find out that indeed the plume was a little bit wider, a little bit deeper than had been anticipated. Change in seasonal flow direction. Sometimes these are very difficult to predict. If you get into a period of a very prolonged drought, your groundwater flow direction can change over time, and some of those are a little bit harder to anticipate with time. And ideally, you'd like to have 3 or 4 years of monitoring data before the PRB goes in, but there's cases where the monitoring period is only about 6 months before a PRB has to be put in for different reasons. Estimation of the groundwater flow velocity is very important for designing to get the residence time right, and that's one of the trickier ones, and it comes back to some of the basic hydrologic characterization data, getting a decent estimate of the groundwater hydraulic conductivity, of the gradient in the area of the PRB, and again, the influence of sewer lines, which, if you turn to slide 17, So this is a map of a groundwater levels of a PRB that was installed next to a road. It was a former dry cleaner site. So the PRB was put in, and during the design phase, we knew that this sewer line, where it's identified with Modern Well 7, was close to the PRB. But there was about 3 or 4 feet of aquifer material between the PRB and the sewer line, and to be honest, it really wasn't given much thought. We thought that there was enough separation between those two that wouldn't have a large impact on the flow field through the PRB. And yet the design of the PRB was to have the flow field go straight through the PRB and not really be affected at all. As you can see by the groundwater contours, the PRB is acting somewhat like a French drain. So we're getting flow down from the right to the left of the PRB towards that Morning Well, or to where Morning Well 7 is. It's the manhole for the sewer, and then the flow would be traveling down the sewer bedding. Fortunately, at this site, there was a Morning Well that they had installed right in the bedding of that manhole, and they've been monitoring that, and it's shown non-detect. So there was some over-design within the PRB. Even though the flow isn't exactly how we expected it, there was some factor safety built into the PRB, and the PRB is meeting the goals. It's treating, it's preventing off-site migration. It's just that the flow field is not as we expected. And as far as I know, they haven't done anything. It's meeting the goals, so they haven't done any retrofit to it. On that, looking back, if you wanted to prevent that, one possible way is to put a small impermeable section close to that manhole to hydraulically disconnect the PRB from that potential conduit. So moving to slide 18, some of the construction-related issues that can happen. This picture there showing a trench being excavated with biopolymer slurry for temporary trench support. With this type of method, it's very important that when you place the reactive material through the biopolymer slurry that you minimize the contact of the reactive material with the biopolymer slurry, because it's going to contain a lot of fines. If you get a lot of mixing between that slurry and the reactive material, you can reduce the permeability of your reactive material and cause hydraulic problems with your PRB. The other issue that can happen in at some sites is reduced permeability at the interface. When you're excavating, if you have some very distinct small sand lenses that are carrying most of the flow within a clay or a plastic type clay, there's a tendency to smear that clay across those sand zones and reduce your permeability into your PRB. And the other thing we see especially with biopolymers, there's a short-term effect on hydraulics. The biopolymer stops the groundwater flow. That's what gives it the trench support. And then when the PRB material is backfilled into it, it takes a bit of time, and I'm talking up a month at most to degrade the residual biopolymer that's left within the trench and restore your hydraulic flow through that PRB. So moving to slide number 19, funnel and gates have their own specific hydraulic issues. A lot of it stems from the fact that you were moving groundwater instead of allowing it to go with its natural path, you're moving it sideways in through a gate where it's treated. So there's some issues that come up with that. It's very important to do some hydraulic modeling to anticipate some of these problems. And other things come up. The picture on the left is the Denver Federal Center PRB that was installed in 1996. And there's a sheet pile wall that creates a funnel section along the alignment, and this is one of the gates being constructed. And what had happened at this site was when they were trying to drive the sheet piles both for the funnel sections and then to create the cofferdam for the gate construction, they had trouble driving the sheet piles down to the depth. So they came in and they pre-excavated the depth of the sheet where the sheet pile is going to be driven, removed that material, and placed it back in no particular order, and then drove the sheet piles through that material. Had no effect on the funnel sections, of course, because there was no water flowing through those, but in the gate section, what had happened is some of that reworked material was left between the sheet pile and the native aquifer, and that bit of reworked material had a lower conductivity than the native aquifer, and that caused flow problems through that gate. So since that time, since they've identified that issue, they've come back and bored out what they call a smear zone, that backfill material that was placed, bore that out, replaced it with a mixture of iron and sand, and they saw a 2 to 3 foot head drop in the wire levels between the upgrade and downgrade side of the gates. So moving to slide number 20, geochemical performance is an important thing. As with iron PRBs, the iron corrosion not only degrades the VOCs, but it also increases the pH and decreases the redox. And mainly due to the increase in pH, we get precipitation of carbonates into the PRB. And so what we need to look at the geochemistry for is really for the long term, how long these iron PRBs will work. So moving to slide 21, so just a bit of more detail on these carbonates. The carbonates are the primary precipitates that will cause long-term issues. Sulfates also may cause it in some cases. But what happens is the pH goes up, you get precipitative calcium carbonate within the iron zone. And if you look carefully at the column test on the left side, you'll notice some white precipitate at the bottom. That's the influent end, and that's the calcium carbonate precipitating out within that column. What lab studies have done and all the data from the field today has shown that the precipitate will start to build at the front face of the PRB, or in this case at the bottom of the column, but it won't plug off at that column. It'll actually move through the column or the PRB over time. So as you get precipitation, the geochemistry changes and the precipitation of calcium stops, and the precipitation will move through the PRB at the front. And so what lab simulations have shown is that you get some permeability loss, and the studies that I've done to date show it's a factor of 1 to 2 change in hydraulic conductivity, which when you consider hydraulic conductivity changes by orders of 10 or so, it's not a huge loss in permeability. But the other issue that happens is shown in the lab is that you lose reactivity due to these precipitates coating the iron. So moving to slide 22, having said that, there is that issue. We're aware that this carbonate precipitate issue will be an issue over the long term, but to date, and we have 10 or 11 years of data so far, there's been no PRB out there that's had a significant loss of reactivity to the point where it's not meeting its goals or it's required some sort of rejuvenation. The other thing to keep in mind is a lot of these studies in the lab, the amount of water that's gone through the columns is much, much more than what we've seen in the field, so it's pushed to an accelerated rate to get results within a reasonable time frame. So most sites, we're looking at least 10 to 15 years of good performance from these PRBs, but that's totally dependent on the mass flux of carbonate. Moving to slide 23, the last of the assessments is a microbial assessment, and again, I'm talking specifically about iron PRBs for treatment of VOCs. And in this is an abiotic reaction, so we're not looking on a microbial degradation of TCE. It's a abiotic reaction. Obviously, if you were looking at a biological PRB, the microbial assessment would be one of your main assessments. But what we do find within these iron PRBs is that microbial activity does occur. There's been no significant biomass buildup, and the only site that's indicated some potential significant biomass buildup was at the Denver Federal Center, and that was the site I talked about where they had trouble driving the sheep piles and they had very low flow through the gates. The microbial assessments that I've done typically show a shift in populations from to sulfate reducers and anaerobic metal reducers, which makes sense as you drive the conditions anaerobic. And there's also some potential beneficial effects of granular iron. As the iron corrodes, you produce some dissolved hydrogen gas. The redox condition is reduced, the VOC flux is reduced as you get treatment through the PRB, and all of these combined, there's definitely a potential beneficial effect to microbial populations within the PRB or directly downgrading the PRB to get further treatment. I'll turn to slide 24. Just going to finish up with the last little bit, go through a cost comparison. This is an analysis that DuPont did as part of that EPA, RTDF, ITRC training course that went around the country. So what an engineer at DuPont did is took it what they consider a typical site with a 50-foot saturated zone, groundwater flow at 1 foot per day, and said, well, we need to cut off the plume. What can we use? And they looked at a PRB with natural attenuation, and that's where the PRB would be designed to treat, to say, 90% of the MCLs, and then natural attenuation was relied on to treat between the PRB and some downgradient compliance point. Pump and treat would be a series of wells along the perimeter, and then monitor natural attenuation. So turning to slide 25, they assumed 10 milligrams per liter of TCE, about 1 milligram per liter of Cis-DC, and about 100 ppb of vinyl chloride, and then treatment down to federal MCLs. So DuPont, based on their data from operating several different pump and treat systems and have installed different PRBs, came up with a cost for the PRBs and a cost for the pump and treat systems. They also assigned a cost per monitoring well, and generally the number of monitoring wells were the same for the PRB and the pump and treat options, but there was more monitoring wells assumed for the monitored natural attenuation. And the operating costs were the annual cost to sample and analyze for, per well, and then the cost to operate the pump and treat system. So turn to slide 26. So this is the results of the analysis. It's plotted in time, the years is on the bottom, and then on the y-axis is the cumulative net present value, and that's calculated by taking the cost of the year they were incurred and then using a rate of inflation of 4% and a rate of return of 12% and bring those costs back to the cost at time zero, and that's how the net present value is costed out. So if you look at time zero, the capital cost of a pump and treat was less than the PRB, which is typically assumed, typically what happens. You can install a pump and treat system less expensive than a PRB, but you can see the annual O&M cost of the pump and treat make the net present value cost increase quite significantly over time. With the PRB, you see the higher capital costs than the pump and treat, and then what they assumed with the 10-year life cycle, and that at the 10-year period, the PRB would be replaced. So there's a bump in the costing, representing a cost to replace the PRB, and again, the PRB would be replaced at year 20. And then the slight increase in cost over the years would be the small cost to do the monitoring of the PRB. PRB with modern natural attenuation is somewhat cheaper, basically because the PRB is a little bit thinner, a little bit less costly to build. And then, of course, if the site's natural attenuation is a viable option at a site, that's going to be your least cheapest option. So when you look at, start looking at 30-year time frame, you can see that the overall cost of PRB is about 4 times less than what the cost would be to install and operate a pump and treat system over that time period. So just moving to slide 27, I'll finish up my section. So really what we find is system hydraulics are the main issues that come up with these PRBs, getting water to flow through them how you want, and that really comes back to proper site characterization is one of the key points, and then the other issue is constructing it, constructing it so that we get the water flowing through it. Continually refining the construction methods to minimize any potential effects of construction as we learn lessons like pre-excavating before driving sheet piles, those sorts of things, hope to prevent problems like this in the future. And as a general estimate, we're looking at least 10 to 15 years, if not longer, is a time frame where these PRBs will be effective for treatment. So with that, I will conclude my section and pass it over to Scott.
Thank you very much, Mike, and good day to everybody. Very happy to be speaking with you from sunny Oakland, California this morning. And I think Mike's last point there as far as the 10 to 15-year expected lifetime is a great place to start off in our next section. So we're on slide number 28, and what I'm going to be doing in the next 30 minutes is going through two case studies, one for the, as Mike mentioned, the first commercial use of iron in a PRB, and the second case would be a little bit more of an innovative use of a different material, that being a zeolite for some ion exchange. Now, on slide 28, we're talking about the site that many of you have perhaps read about or heard about and seen in other courses, that in the South San Francisco Bay Area, former industrial manufacturing site, where there are favorite hosts of chlorinated compounds, were released into soil and water through manufacturing operations over the 1980s and such. Now, one of the things that's very interesting, if we go back in time and history, back to 1991, where the baseboard of the site was first being installed and looked at, ETI hadn't really been formed as a company, and the University of Waterloo was involved in a university consortium with industry talking about different new ways of treating VOCs and other contaminants in groundwater. At that time, what we were all doing, as you all know, we're trying to figure out how to get away from some of the pump and treat issues because of the time and the expense, and you get to a point where you just can't reduce as much mass anymore. and also the impacts on the economic redevelopment of industrial properties. So that really started the whole trend of looking at PRBs and other in-situ aspects. This site in Sunnyvale was a prime candidate to try something new. We had a pump and treat system in there. It had been effective for about 7 years, but we were not able to reduce the mass down to the cleanup goals at that time. And also for this site, because of the on-site active treatment systems, meaning the above ground treatment system, a large air stripper, et cetera, the actual site cannot be reused by another industry. So this is a perfect example of trying to get this going. I will refer you back to the ITRC documents on PRBs. There are a number of them out there that Juliana had mentioned before. I really encourage you to take a look at that, and you'll see a lot more details. What I'm going to try and do, though, is point to specific aspects that we have learned over the last 10 to 12 years. I'm not going to necessarily say, hey, this chemical is being degraded, that's being degraded. It's more important to focus on what are those other aspects that are really important for sustaining these PRB systems. And I think that's the takeoff that we want to try and continue with. So let's move to slide number 29.
Scott, this is Juliana.
Yes.
I'd like to interrupt quickly.
Yes.
If you're participating in an office and using a phone line, please double check that your phone is on mute. We're getting a little bit of background noise. And also, Scott, if you could just speak up just a little bit more, that would help us out.
Certainly will. Is that a little bit better for you?
That's a little bit better. Thank you.
Okay, will do. Okay, let's get, we'll continue on here with slide number 29. The basic site history, which I kind of went through a little bit, is that back in the early 80s, through site characterization, you identify the VOCs. It was that 1991 to 1993 time frame where the information from the University of Waterloo provided the best information that there is another technique that we might be able to look at. And at that time, it was great. We actually involved a number of disciplines from microbiology, engineering, structural engineering, hydrogeology, and, of course, the legal team to look at, can we actually look at an in-situ type remedy? This was so new at that time that it took a couple of years to actually get the public approval to go through with this. But in November of 1994, the construction began, and site construction was finished by early 1995. We've gone through a number of five-year effectiveness evaluations, and now we're actually approaching year 12. And the things that are really important that I think to see is that back in 1991, we were hoping that this type of system would last 5 years, and I think now we're on the verge of hitting that 15-year mark with still not a heck of a lot of reduction in the apparent effectiveness of this technology. We have seen some things that perhaps we didn't know or we couldn't design for at the time. One is there is a lot of gas and hydrogen that is produced. Two, the geochemical considerations are very important, and the hydraulic considerations are very important. And what's going to happen sometimes if you have an in-situ system where, in fact, nobody can see it? We don't have above-ground systems. We don't have big towers. If we don't protect these systems from potential nearby construction and other land use development, we may have some physical effects. For example, we did have a slurry wall breach, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit because that's important for in-situ systems. Let's move to slide number 30 very briefly. I'm going to go over some of the layout issues, hydraulic issues that we've learned, some of the basic geochemical considerations. The gas measurements, I think, are important. Mike alluded to the fact that there's a positive benefit from the gas, as well as some things that we want to keep our eye out for. And, well, how have these things done economically over the last decade? Let's move to slide number 31. 31 is the basic block diagram of what we're talking about for this particular site. It's a fairly small system, a fairly shallow system. We're trying to tie into an underlying aquitard clay material that's perhaps about 6 to 7 meters, 20 to 25 feet depth. We have designed this particular site to over-encompass the thin 2 to 10 foot thick aquifer zone so that we have a full capture of that. And also you'll notice, particularly when we get to the next slide, that this old, let's call it the Model A or the Model T version of the granular iron PRB, is an iron core, the granular iron core, which is surrounded by pea gravel. And the reason for doing that were to look at some of the hydraulic aspects, and not intended, but what we found is that there's a beneficial aspect of actually having a slight mixed zone where we don't have the 100% iron. We actually have a mixed iron gravel zone that is surrounding the iron core, and that has a benefit in some of the geochemical aging aspects, and we'll talk about that in a moment too. Moving to slide number 32 is the photograph, the picture that kind of fits the whole thing. This is what's called the idealized looking PRB system. As Mike mentioned, there are a whole bunch of different ways to install these now. There are thin jetted barriers. There are other deep, let's call them redox manipulated barriers, et cetera. This is the way the first ones went in. They were essentially trenched materials backfilled with the appropriate both reactive material and pea gravel on the side. Dimensions are there for you. There are a number of papers that are referred to both here in the notes as well as in the ITRC documents. Those white pipes there were the monitoring wells, which were essentially hung into the PRB as it was being built. Subsequent to the construction, additional wells were actually direct pushed into the middle of the iron zone to get some additional information as far as what was happening in the middle. This system was, let's call it, was built conservatively. From the lab studies that were performed by the university, by ETI at the time, we probably could have gotten away with a system that was half as wide, so 2 foot thick, flow through thickness, and perhaps half the amount of iron, that being 50% versus 100%. But because this was the first system, it was conservatively built with twice the width, twice the amount, and with the T-grav on the site. You'll notice looking at this picture, if you look at the boundaries between the gravel and the iron, there are some intermediate sheets, temporary sheets, that were put in during the backfilling. Those were pulled. Now, when the exterior sheets were pulled, due to the vibration and the permeability and porosity differences or size differences of the grains, we actually had some mixing along those boundaries, and that became very important later on. Slide number 33. We should all be on. Looks like a whole host of shotgun wells out there and the general layout of the system, which included some slurry well systems. The longest one is about 300 feet, which helped to, this is not the, you call it the funnel and gate, but it's really not to funnel more water into a smaller space, but it's more to create plume control, because at this site, due to historical pumping in the general vicinity and other recharge and precipitation issues, we did see changes in the historical groundwater flow direction. So these slurry walls were actually put in. A number of the wells that you see there, primarily if you're looking at your figure, P30 through, say, P38, along the lower edge of that upper slurry wall system, were put in after the fact. And this is one of the lessons learned, that construction issues next to a site can damage the whole hydraulic system. Remember, these TRBs are only going to work if the hydraulics work. And so you have to be able to either control that or conservatively over-design them. Well, what happened at one point is that neighboring construction actually built and dug right into the slurry wall, pumped on that site through a dewatering system, and we've had water going the other way, actually to the right on your picture versus the left, which is toward the left, which is the actual flow direction that we wanted. So therefore, a number of these pedometers were actually put in to try and identify where the breach was, and they were very effective in identifying the breach, looking at water levels, and we actually go to the next slide, 34, and you actually see that, in fact. If you look down, this is a hydrograph of water levels over approximately a 9-10 year period. You'll see in this part of California, we have our seasonal highs because of high precipitation and recharge, and then we have our seasonal lows because of the summer non-rain conditions. Well, you notice around 1995, there's a fairly significant depression in the hydrographic record. And that was at the time that this slurry wall breach occurred. Pumping on the other side of the wall caused water to actually flow the other direction. Now, the interesting thing about that is that a big deal? I mean, these systems are there to, the iron can treat water no matter which way it's going. However, the placement of the monitoring wells is actually important because you may not be able to see, for example, if water's being treated. And, of course, if you're trying to contain a plume, but the water's going the other way, well, you may be containing your plume, that's correct, but you're pulling in water from the other side, which may have other chemicals. For example, in these highly concentrated industrial areas, oftentimes we have neighboring plumes of different chemicals, which actually occurred here as well. But you'll see that following that period, there was a slurry injection program, which actually effectively fixed that slurry wall breach, and we went back to our typical hydrographic record. Moving to slide 35, also important, another very important consideration, in building these in-situ walls, we are essentially building treatment trench drains, if you will, or big permeable trenches, so sometimes into what are confined systems. So we're creating a semi-confined or unconfined system into a confined system. That has hydraulic ramifications. Sometimes you are, in fact, going to see that the pressure changes within that reactive system cause either a depression within your PRB hydraulically, or perhaps it might cause some mounding. And this hydrograph here, the point here was to identify that. In fact, this was at the front of one of the storms that we were tracking back in December of 2002. And without going to what each of these actual curves are, you can actually look back at a paper that's documented in the ITRC document to find this. What we actually saw that is due to the pressure changes of having a what's called an unconfined PRB that was built into a semi-confined or confined natural aquifer, we saw at the initial recharge event, we actually had a slight depression that occurred within the PRB itself, hydraulically. However, after that, what we saw was a slight mound that occurred, and that mound was transient and then dissipated. Why is that important? Well, perhaps over the long term, it's not. Things go up and down, and that's fine. But if you have sustained mounding, for example, well, obviously you're going to have a hydraulic blocking of your flow system. If you have a sustained depression, you have water coming in from both sides. The point is that the hydraulics are very important, and we need to understand this, or we should understand that going forward in design. Let's move to slide number 36. Another important aspect we were very interested in over the 10-year history of this site was, well, what about the velocity? What about the water flow through the PRB? Are we seeing any kind of reduction in flow? We ran some point dilution testing, and the results from this essentially confirmed to us that we are still getting flow through the system. The system was designed for about a half a foot per day linear velocity, and the results here are, I would say, relatively similar to what we expected after about 9 years of operation. We can talk about that during the question and answer period if you have any questions about that as well. Quickly through slide number 37, pH conditions. This particular system, we're running pretty consistently around pH 11, but on the downside of that PRB system, we do see a natural reduction of that pH back to the ambient 7.5 or 8. That's an important consideration. I think most of you have already seen that. Moving to slide number 38, the EH-pH relationship also is important. This system works because of the natural reduction as well as the direct contact with the metal surface. Is there something about the EH-pH relationship on this Forbay diagram that we can track with time that talks about the aging of this reaction? The folks at Battelle, I know, Bruce Sass, for example, and others have done some modeling saying that, you know, over time as the corrosion process on the iron PRB continues, you may get continued reduction. At some point, perhaps if your pH does trend to get quite high, for example, 13 or 14, there may be some instability in the reaction rate. I know that that's still an ongoing area of research by a number of academic areas. I think this is something just to keep track on. Is this a real drift that we're seeing? Well, I don't know. The data seem to say that maybe there is some drift, but then there's a stabilization still in that very low reduction area and also very high pH. Slides 39 and 40 really just are there to kind of show you basically what we see as far as VOC concentrations of VOCs going through it. I'm not going to spend time. We know up gradient we have concentrations within the wall itself. We get very good concentration reduction. But the down gradient, it takes a long time to get complete flushing through these PRBs to see that actual reduction of VOCs on the down gradient side. I think that's important. And the other important thing, as Mike alluded to earlier, these PRBs are typically built in the middle of plumes. They're not typically at the very downgrading edge of a plume where the downgradient water is perfectly clean and you just have concentrations on the upgrading side. So it's going to take time. These PRBs are there for really plume control. They're for source area control. They're not necessarily going to be designed to treat an entire huge, large plume of dilute concentrations because of the passive nature of working with the hydraulics. I think that's an important consideration for where you're going to locate these things. Slide number 40, very quickly, I was alluding to the mixture of the iron and the gravel on the upgrading side. Very interestingly, with a little bit of iron in that gravel, you do get a fairly quick pH shift, for example. For example, with just maybe, I'd say, 10% iron or so within the gravel, we might see a pH shift from ambient 7.5 up to 8 or 9. At that time, you're going to get that carbon equilibrium shift occurring right there. that's actually a good thing because within the gravel there, you have a bit more porosity to handle the precipitation, which is protective of the iron core. That's an interesting design consideration, which we all should keep in mind as well. Slide number 41, we produce gas. This reaction of iron in water and the corrosion is going to produce gas, hydrogen, and methane, depending on the other geochemical considerations. Over time, what is that gas production going to do? Is it going to decrease? The data that we have from this site over three events from 1997 to 2004 suggests that maybe there is a reduction in the gas production over that time, but it's still extremely high. The hydrogen is still at least half the solubility. I believe, are seeing some of that gas halo outside of the wall, which can be a good thing, as Mike mentioned, as far as creating the reduction that we need to help some of the other biological reduction processes. I think this is important. From a design consideration, our colleagues, I know some of them in Germany have designed these systems as a funnel and gate, which essentially where the funnel or the gate is capped, and I think they've seen some gas buildup, which has created some reduction in permeability and the flow-through nature of the system. That's also an important consideration. We haven't seen that here yet, but it's something that we are actually looking at, keeping our eye on. Slide number 42, how is this system done economically? What you see here are three curves or lines in this figure. The upper one, and I'm sorry that the dashes unfortunately look a little bit too similar, but this upper dash is what the projected cost would have been of the existing pump and treat system at this site. And as you can see that the costs continue, you can only optimize so much. The goal was to get something else that would have been more cost effective. The lower two lines include both the solid line of what the actual costs are to date, at least through 2004, and they're similar through the end of 2005, and then what was projected. And I think what this is trying to show is that in actual dollars, although the dollar sign is not shown on this figure, in fact, the PRB is successful in terms of reducing the overall cost. In fact, I'd say that from the client's perspective, the return on investment for this site, including the capital and other changes in the site management based on using the PRB, the ad investment was returned in about 3 years. And now we're in year 12, so the costs continue. So slide 43 is really just a summary of the Sunnyvale site after 10 years. We still are achieving the water quality goals for this site, although there are things that we're keeping an eye on. We're aging. We're now at 12 years. We're looking for signs that if there is going to be a problem, we can react to it. We still see the hydrogen gas that is being produced. The economic property is being used for another site use, which has been terrific, another industrial and commercial use of it. Mineralization is going to occur. We see that. We see the pH change. We see the dropout of inorganic. So the question is, can we maintain the permeability through time? Okay. Let's move on to slide 44, and we're going to shift a little bit here over the next 10 minutes and talk about zeolitic PRB. The point here was that the PRB is really a concept of how to create an in-situ treatment system. There's no one way to do it. There's no one reactive material. The geometry can be different. The whole injection method or installation method can be different. This is another way to look at it. In this case, this was a site up in the West Valley facility in New York, south of Buffalo. Strontium 90 was the primary chemical of concern at this site. The site was interested in trying to do something else rather than pumping and treating for eternity, at least probably for eternity. How do we do something where we can actually capture the affected groundwater and keep that strontium 90 in place using an ion exchange system in this case? So this is what was looked at. There was a lot of work done by the folks at the University of Buffalo, Alan Rabideau, and others to try and design the system. The picture here kind of shows you a little bit about what the zeolite material looks like. It's a clinotillite mineral. That's the white powder compared to the New York quarter, and then a little look at what the iron is. Now, the ring structure is what is effective here as far as the zeolite is concerned. The zeolite is a slightly anionic mineral. That structure allows the larger cation, in this case strontium, to actually replace the existing central either calcium or potassium within that ring structure. Let's move to slide number 45, which is really just a location map south of Buffalo. The issue here was that this is a Department of Energy site. back in the 1960s, there was a process water line break. Cerania 90 was released. The idea was to look at a PRB which could actually use material that had been used in the above ground pump and treat system. So that being the zeolite to promote the removal through an ion exchange. You know, strontium 90 has a relatively reasonable decay rate as far as radioactive materials go. It's about 27 years. There's a way to take that to our advantage in designing the system, and that was what the point was here. Why am I talking about this site? Slide number 46, where we should be. There were some issues that were discovered following the installation of this site. We came into it after the system was in to try and identify why the site was not seeing some of the performance effectiveness that they were hoping. There were some hydraulic issues. They saw some mounding. They weren't necessarily getting the treatment that they had hoped. Well, one of the things, and I'll go to the end here, is that pilot systems are not designed necessarily to be perfect. What we're doing in a pilot system is trying to identify those things we need to know for designing the long-term system. And also, treatment takes time. It's not going to happen necessarily right away. And that's what we saw here, is that with this ion exchange process, there was some time needed for the system after construction to actually return back to a, let's call it an equilibrium, and start showing the reduction that we needed. So let's go through a couple of very quick pictures here and get right to the data. Slide 47, the general concept. We saw that before in the last section. Essentially, we had the 2 meter wide PRB flow through. The zeolite was placed on one side. There was a pea gravel area that was placed up front to help with development, as well as some of the hydraulic control. Slide 48 and a couple others after that, some construction pictures. This was essentially the cofferdam approach, sheet pile, trench out, and backfill in. Slide 49 shows a couple of additional construction pictures, trenching out of the middle with the sheet piles, and then on the right side of your photograph, the placement of the white granular zeolitic material. Okay, slide number 50. Let's get right down to this step here. Hydraulically, the data before the PRB was installed indicated that there was a flow direction that was on your page here straight to the north. However, after the PRB went in and after some additional work on hydraulics were performed, there was a much more apparent set of information that said that the water flow was probably more at an angle toward the northeast. That is really important because this pilot system was designed as an uncontrolled, a hydraulically uncontrolled PRB. In other words, water was not being controlled by sheet piles or pumping. That's really important as far as looking at the performance assessment and what you had designed for. This kind of goes into the fact that hydraulic information, as Mike mentioned before and as I mentioned in our future speakers will, is critical to the success of the PRB. On slide number 51, in fact, what we saw was later there was some mounding that was occurring through by a number of reasons, which we found out later. But I believe actually that if with this small system, now this was only about a 10-foot long system in what is a large, large plume and hydraulic system, I would think that you either have to extend the PRB out to pilot test or you have to put some sort of hydraulic control so you best get the design information that you're interested in. Otherwise, you're trying to actually prove whether the system is working or not, when in reality, you want to get the data that you need for designing the long system. Some of the issues that we found, let's move to slide 52. This is a schematic of the hydrostratigraphic section. The PRB outline is shown in front of you. This is a sand, silty clay, gravel section on top of its hill. What we believe we saw was that the PRB was not completely tied into the underlying hill, so therefore we had some underflow conditions. That was a very important thing. And actually, you notice the very thin nature of the silt and clay and sand. That affects the hydraulics and where, in this case, the strontium 90 was flowing through. And what we found later on was that that strontium 90, the primary plume was through a very narrow lens. That is important for design details and actually probably explained in some respects why we saw some flow going around due to the construction method. That is the sheet piling method. You can imagine pounding these things down and actually smearing the face, essentially creating a skin along those silt and clay layers, which actually can affect the direction that the contaminants are flowing. Slide number 53, just indicating that there were some pumping tests both within and external to the PRB at this time to try and identify because we were not seeing the type of flow that we were hoping, if there was hydraulic connection, we did see that. So the pressure response was actually favorable for that. Slide number 54, let's move to that. Some of the other aspects that we saw during construction, which are really important for designing these systems and implementing these systems, is that we can't assume that when we install a system, whether it's by injection, whether it's by sheet piling, whether it's by trenching, that the native material is going to remain the same from the standpoint of its position, from its grain size, from lack of smearing. I believe what we saw here was, in fact, that we did see smearing due to the construction. This is a schematic of a number of things that happened. I believe that we actually saw some surface infiltration during storm events because there was not an effective cap initially on top of the system as well. And actually, we also believe that in some case the sheets themselves probably moved and perhaps crushed the clientelite just a little bit and created finer zones, which also created some smearing opportunities. Slide number 55, you know, one of the things that comes up if you're seeing a system that isn't performing as you would hope is ways to fix it. Well, one of the ways to fix it, because these are passive systems, is to look at pumping regimes. You know, we design these PRVs primarily not to use pumping. That's the whole benefit and the goal of this. But in some cases, we might say that maybe there's a low level of pumping to try and provide some additional hydraulic control without using sheets or other physical barriers, which might be helpful. And these pictures are here really just to show that, in fact, you can do some numerical modeling. This is just simple analytical modeling to identify whether, in fact, adding pumping or truing up pumps that might already be there might actually help and control some of the hydraulics. I know that if you have downloaded this presentation, there are speaker notes which are associated here which describe what each of these are, but essentially looking at where to place a pump, how can you control the flow if in fact you have some smearing and some lack of hydraulic communication at any portion of the system. Okay, let's move to slide number 56. One of the things, and we'll wrap it up just here in the next couple slides, slide 56 is a concentration graph over time of looking at three fairly important parameters that we were interested in, that being calcium, that being potassium, and that being the strontium 90. Why are we interested in this? Well, remember, this is an ion exchange type of a program. What we see as an effective sign that the zeolite is actually removing strontium 90 from the groundwater system is we actually see, in this case, a potassium plume that starts to evolve from the PRB. That's the replacement mechanism. So one of the things that was really important is that if you look primarily at the upper slide, you see not a heck of a lot of change between those three parameters. In fact, it looked like there was no strontium 90 whatsoever within the middle of the wall. Well, that might be good, but is that really what's important in determining whether this system is being successful? Well, if we just have mounding because of surface infiltration, for example, that's where we're not capturing the plume, then no, that doesn't tell us anything. So let's now look at the downgradient well instead. In the 2000 to 2001 time frame, it certainly looked like there was not a heck of a lot of treatment of strontium 90. The orange dots in the middle there, the orange line, seemed to indicate that strontium 90 continued to increase. There was no potassium plume coming out of there. So what does that mean? Well, it seems to say that there's nothing going on, not effective treatment. But along 2001 or so, we started to see that shift in those trends. We started to see the reduction in strontium 90, and we started to see the increase in potassium. A very good sign, in fact, that the treatment was occurring and we're starting to get the flow through that we needed to show, in fact, that the treatment was occurring. So part of it is time. Part of it is these things aren't going to happen overnight, and as we're working with our design team, our regulators, and stakeholders, we should indicate that PRBs are not those immediate fixes. They're going to take time, but if you get the right data, that would be helpful in improving that. So slide 57, and we'll wrap up this section. What are the things that are important? They're the same things that we've been saying over the last 10 years. Site characterization is critical. We want to develop enough data so that we can actually design for the conditions. One size does not fit all in this case. Every system is unique. Pay attention to those hydraulic conditions, and really pay attention to the vertical and lateral heterogeneity in not only the hydraulics, but also in your stratigraphic sequence. Where is the flow going through? You know, the the 20-foot wells, the large borings to get data may not be as effective as some of those more discrete data points that we can get. Keep in mind the pilot testing objectives. They're not to be perfect. They're really just to get the data that you need if you go through a pilot test to design your full-scale system. You can have failure and still in a pilot test and still have a very successful full-scale test. Construction methods do affect hydraulics. They do affect the fate and the migration of your contaminants. Keep that in mind as we're putting this in. And remember, this whole thing is about designing the details for the full-scale installation. So with that, slide 58, and I think we can have a brief Q&A section.
Thank you, Scott. This is Juliana. If you're on our phone line, you'll have the opportunity now to ask some questions. If you've muted your phone, please remember to unmute. It is *7 if you use our system. We ask that you state your name and location when asking a question. Our simulcast audience, please use the orange question mark button at the top of the screen. Do we have questions now from our phone line audience?
Yeah, Juliana, this is Eric Nuttall in Albuquerque. Quick question. I assume that you want to get the permeability and the conductivity down below the formation value so that you're not going to have water running around. If you were doing geotechnical injection where you put anything else in, I assume that it would be higher and that would be problematic. Maybe they could comment on that situation if you had additives like nano iron or something. Also, did your calcium precipitate lower your permeability?
Yeah, this is Mike Duchesne. I didn't quite catch the bit about injecting from a geotechnical point of view, but as far as the carbonates go, yeah, we do see a reduction in permeability. I'd mentioned that the lab studies have shown a drop by a factor of 2 or 3 in permeability. So if you start out around 5 × 10⁻², then you would drop down to around 2 × 10⁻²² centimeters per second for permeability, which most sites won't be an issue.
I'm sorry, Eric, I'm also trying to understand your question a little bit, but it seemed like you're asking about injecting materials that perhaps were not granular to either as a treatment material or as a hydraulic grouting material.
Well, if you were doing nano iron, for example, or micro iron, or anything you added like a carbon source geotechnically, it seems like you'd be reducing permeability, which would give you a problem and potential problem with regard to the hydraulic conductivity through the barrier. I tend to bypass it.
Yeah, I think the point is well taken in that kind of leading off to where we ended is that anything you inject is going to change the hydraulic conditions somewhat. And understanding what those potential effects are is important. If it's a very narrow, small-scale, lengthwise PRB, then that might be much more important. For example, if you had a much wider or longer system that has, let's call it, greater capacity to take some of these other conductivity heterogeneities into effect. In other words, you know, what additional safety factor as far as the flow can you build into it? But you're right. Those need to be taken into consideration.
Good.
Thank you. This is Juliana from our simulcast audience. Mary Rose Casa at the California Regional Water Quality Control Board asks, she refers to slide 17, the discussion about the sewer influences. Does this assume that the depth of the groundwater is shallower than the sewer system? If groundwater is 20 to 30 feet below ground, would the sewer system be such a problem?
Yeah, this is Mike Duchesne. Yeah, no, that's a good point. I didn't point out, but at this site, the water table is about 4 feet below grade, and the sewers would have gone about 5 or 6 feet down. So the sewers were indeed in the water table, but if your sewers are above the water table, then they won't have any influence.
Thank you. Another simulcast question from Virgil Casaruna at Booz Allen Hamilton in Texas. Slide 22, bullet 2. By how much less was the measured on-site flow through relative to the lab test?
Yeah, you'd have to look at specific sites for that. Some of the sites, there's been more flow through it basically because of the groundwater flow velocity. So if you have a really low groundwater flow velocity, even if the PRB's been operating 10, 15 years, you have very little bit of flow through it. Whereas, say, with a higher groundwater flow velocity, you'll get more water through it per year. So you'd expect to see some issues quicker on those sites to sites. So just as a general comment, though, the amount of water that's pumped through these laboratory columns is typically more than what we would see over a 10 to 15 year period in most PRBs.
Thank you. And one more simulcast before we go back to the phone line. This is from Jeff Valvik at Jacques Whitford Consulting in Pennsylvania. Can you describe common methods of controlling pH in situ in a passive system? Our groundwater has a pH of 5, and we need a pH of about 8.
Oh, I guess you need more information of why the pH is 5 and then come up with an issue. Dave Smith will show you a site where the pH is low because it's acid mine drainage, and then they increase the pH by precipitation of the metals and reducing the acid-generating potential of the water. So it really depends on why your pH is low, and then work with that to get a treatment method to bring that pH up.
Thank you. Do we have questions now from our phone line audience?
I've got a question.
And you are?
This is Michael O'Hearn with MacTech Engineering in Novi, Michigan.
Yes.
Slide 58 shows the two different methods for placing the PRB material in the ground. You know, one is to hold the trench open with the biopolymer mud type of material, and the other is with the sheet piling. The statement was made to try to minimize the contact between the biopolymer mud and the PRB material. I don't understand how you can do that. Are you placing the PRB material into the hole, into the trench, and displacing the mud? How can you minimize the contact if you do that?
Yeah, basically what I was referring to, and just to go back, those aren't the only two methods that are used. We went through the methods in more detail in the second internet course, so they're not repeated here, but if you go through the, I believe the PRB4 document, it goes through all the different types of installation methods, but really the most common method that's used is to install a tremie pipe and place the iron and sand material, or any material for that matter, through the tremie pipe down to close to where it falls. So instead of simply dumping the iron sand material through the into the top of the trench and letting it fall through the slurry, you dump it through a tremie pipe, which minimizes the contact.
Thank you.
This is Juliana. I have an additional question from our simulcast audience. This is Daniel Suzanne from ENSR in Italy. The case histories show pretty low reduction of COCs, down gradient of the PRB. Is this expected? How can you provide a time schedule for the site closure?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think that's the one that we all here get asked a lot. And a lot of it depends on what your whole intent is. Site closure has a lot of different meanings in a lot of different places. For these cases, primarily, though, what we're seeing is what our intent is to try and reduce the migration off of a source area so that we actually get some destruction. And that's why I was mentioning that the PRBs are typically not put at the very down gradient of these plumes, primarily because water typically doesn't flow that fast, and the lifetime of these PRBs, if they're 15 years or 20 years, cannot hope to capture every single aspect of the plume. But site closure might end up with a site reuse instead of complete closure. It might end up in a no further additional action. The Sunnyvale case, why that was so important is that even though we don't have site closure, we were able to reduce costs by about $300,000 U.S. dollars per year. Often what you might need to look at is how can the PRB help you with site closure by looking at an additional treatment method. Maybe it's monitored natural attenuation downgrading of the plume if you can control or cut off your source with the PRB.
Thank you. Another simulcast before I go back to the phone line. This is from Keith Argoarla at Haley and Aldrich in Michigan. Related to funnel and gate systems, do you find that slurry walls or sheet pile walls work better? Do you find that sheet piles allow water through?
Oh, that's kind of a question that's just beyond the PRB. It really is a hydraulic containment issue. I guess we've used, or both have been used for PRBs, and I guess the one comment on the sheet piles that I can pass along is I know if you don't do proper sealing of the joints in the sheet piles, then I've heard conductivities of 10 to the minus 4 centimeters per second as a bulk conductivity for the sheet pile because you get so much flow through the joints.
Okay.
So but there are other different types of barriers out there where you can seal up the joints and get a better sealing system. So I guess my comment is it's really site specific, and both sheep pile walls and slurry walls have been used.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I'd also add that the funnel and gate approach is inherently more complicated or needs some even additional design consideration, just because we're adding additional variables, and that is we're trying to actually route the water versus trying to just cut off the ambient flow that's already there.
Do we have another question from our phone line audience?
Yeah, I got one. Can you hear me?
Yes, and your name is?
I'm John Spielberg, Michigan Department of Environmental Quality in Michigan. We have I help manage an NPL site in Clare where we have a PRB that was installed a couple Decembers ago. And some of the early data suggests that there may be some slight flow around the PRB and mounding on one side. And we're just, one concern that we had during the construction was smearing during the actual trenching operation. Do you have any other data or experience with the effects of smearing during the construction phase of installing these trenches?
Mike, we can probably both answer that one.
That one, I believe, was installed with a continuous trencher?
Yes.
Is that the one? Yeah, there was another site where that was suspected in Kansas City. There was a clay layer, and then underneath there was a basal gravel layer, and there's some suspicion, although it never was fully determined, but there's a suggestion that some of the clay from the upper zone got mixed and created a smear zone on overlying that basal gravel zone at the bottom. Scott, you were going to add another one?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, even though the installation method was different, the West Valley site that we chatted about earlier, I believe had some of the same issues, where just from the standpoint of installing the sheet piles initially, there was smearing from some of the upper clay layers down into the sandier zones that was actually controlling the plume. And so we actually did some analysis using the data we had, monitoring well data, numerical analysis to identify, well, how much of that front of the PRB is actually potentially covered, and is there still enough capacity in areas that perhaps aren't smeared to take care of the additional flow. And our final conclusion was that, yeah, we probably did have smearing over at least half of that, but because of the permeability contrast and the hydraulics, we were still able to get enough treatment and flow through that PRB. But I think that goes into the whole design issue as far as we're going to have some smearing and we're going to have some changes in these PRBs someplace. Nothing is going to be perfect. So is there some additional conservation in the design, either by increasing the length or adding some of the hydraulic control factors that can overcome some of those likely smearing things that are going to occur?
Thank you, instructors. I have one last simulcast question. This is from Heather Lynn at Golder Associates in New Jersey. Will there be a full-scale implementation of the zeolite PRB?
Well, that's a good question. I've been asking that now for a couple of years. I believe what the site history at this point up there, and I know that there are a number of issues up there that we can't really go over here because it just would take too long to talk about. It's still on the plans that a full-scale PRB is possible, but they've also done a number of health risk assessments, some additional fate and migration assessments for the West Valley site up there, and looking at really where the risk and receptors are. So at this point, while it's on the table, they still have some site closure issues to kind of work out. So the answer is we don't know. Maybe someday, hopefully.
We need to wrap up this Q&A, even though we do have more questions. We'll try to get those in the next Q&A session. If everyone will help us out by putting your phone back on mute, it is *6 to mute, and then I'll remind you again, *7 to unmute during the next Q&A session. On slide 59, I'll turn our presentation over to Alec Noble of the California Water Quality Regional Control Board. Alec?
Okay, thank you, Juliana. Can everybody hear me okay? Is that good?
I can.
Great. Okay. Well, good morning or good afternoon, whatever the case may be where you are. I'm Alec Noggle with the California Water Quality Control Board. Beginning on slide 59, I want to change directions a little bit and focus on a unique kind of PRB that we're calling a biobarrier. In my presentation, I plan to first talk about what a biobarrier is and how one functions, and then some of the materials that are used in biobarriers. Then I'll present a brief case example of a large-scale biobarrier that's been installed at a California facility for the treatment of chlorinated solvents. And in that case example, I'm primarily going to focus on the regulatory issues and some of the challenges with operation and maintenance of a large-scale biobarrier. Now, just so you're aware, there is an introduction to the biobarriers that's presented in sections 1 and 2 of the 2005 PRB guidance document. Moving to slide 60, well, so what is a biobarrier? Essentially, it's a bioremediation remedy that's deployed like a PRB that we've been talking about. This means that various materials, which are intended to stimulate biodegradation, are going to be emplaced in the subsurface in a linear fashion, just the way an iron PRB would, in order to create a biotreatment zone, which is, again, aligned perpendicular to groundwater flow. The goal is to intercept and treat those contaminants as the groundwater flows through. Now, the figure here shows a series of wells that are used to inject liquid or gaseous amendments. What you can see here is that there's space to create a single continuous biotreatment zone by overlapping the radii of influence. It's important to note that biobarrier materials that are typically intended to stimulate either aerobic or anaerobic biodegradation rather than treatment of the contaminants through direct abiotic destruction, which is the case with the iron PRBs. It's also important to note that the degree to which a biobarrier functions passively depends on how the materials must be added and whether or not they need to be circulated in the subsurface. Slide 61. This is a picture of a biobarrier that's installed at the Port Hueneme site in California. It uses a combination of air and oxygen to treat MTBE and BTEX compounds. What you see here is the linear arrangement of the injection wells that are perpendicular to the direction of groundwater flow. And you can also see several monitoring wells that are just a few feet down gradient of the linear biobarrier. Now the goal again is to use enough injection points to ensure overlap so that you think you have a continuous barrier. One unique aspect of the biobarrier is that it is hard to know exactly what the size and the shape of the biotreatment zone actually is in the subsurface. In some cases, that zone may actually extend well down gradient of where you've injected the materials. Now keep in mind that there's no trench, there's no excavation, and no direct emplacement of reactive materials. Basically, the injection wells are the delivery system. Other biobarriers, particularly those that use solid amendments such as wood chips or compost, will require the use of a trench to emplace those materials, the same as with an iron PRB. Table 2-4 and Appendix D in the 2005 PRB guidance document, I think they list over a dozen or so biobarrier sites nationwide. Moving to slide 62. The amendments used for in-situ bioremediation are typically grouped into four broad categories that you see here in this slide. Typically, each amendment is good for treating a specific type of contaminant by way of a particular biodegradation process. For example, the compost is effective at treating acid mine drainage. Wood chips and compost and mulch are also being used to treat chlorinated solvents and, in some cases, perchlorate. Many liquid amendments are also useful at treating chlorinated solvents by way of anaerobic biodegradation, and then air and oxygen that you just saw at the Port Hueneme site are used for treating petroleum hydrocarbons as well as chlorinated solvents, but by way of aerobic biodegradation. And then lastly, you can add various microbial cultures to the mix in a process known as bioaugmentation. Slide 63. Now I'd like to present the case example that I mentioned. This is a large-scale biobarrier that's installed at an industrial site in California that's along a river, which you can see at the top of the figure. That's the northward direction. The system was designed to treat a large chlorinated solvent plume. The primary constituents, which you can see in the table to the lower right, are perchloroethylene PCE and carbon tetrachloride. Those are the parent compounds, and then you can see some of the daughter products, the TCE, the 1,2-DCE, and the chloroform. The solvent source area is shown here in red, and for sense of scale, this is over 1,000 feet long, so it's much larger than your typical source area. It is an industrial facility where they manufacture these chlorinated solvents. The green arrows represent the dominant groundwater flow paths. The relative magnitude of groundwater flow is indicated by the relative arrow thickness. And basically what it shows is that groundwater flows northward, but it diverges as it flows northward due to hydraulic conductivity changes and in the area, but ultimately discharges to the river or to the lagoon on the right side. The table in the lower right corner summarizes those parent and daughter compounds that I mentioned, but you can see three depth zones, A, B, and C, and the indicated depth ranges. So essentially you have fairly high concentrations all the way down to almost 135 feet. Slide 64. So this site, based on the conditions, the widespread distribution of the contaminants and their depth, subsurface circulation system was selected, and this figure shows both a profile view and a plan view of how this system creates the biotreatment zone. So looking at the profile view in the upper left, what you see is you can see how the liquid amendments are added to each of the circulation wells. The black and white arrows then indicate the mixing directions via pumping using injection or extraction in those wells. Tracer testing was performed to help confirm the mixing pattern that you see here. It also was used to estimate contaminant residence time within the treatment zone, because obviously that's an important factor, just as is the case with all PRBs. So the goal of the circulation is to mix these amendments, but also provide a degree of hydraulic capture of the contaminants. The plan view to the lower right shows how the system functions like a bioreactor. This shows that the contaminated groundwater is captured and then it's circulated before it eventually then resumes its downgradient migration, where it's sampled by a strategically placed monitoring or effluent monitoring well. Slide 65. The biobarrier layout shown here was selected based on the size of the source zone and the groundwater flow paths, as well as other site constraints. What you see is three segments. There are each of these three segments shown here in green are essentially linear features. Each has 13 circulation wells, and each well is spaced roughly about 100 feet apart. So, it's a fairly long, large-scale biobarrier. So a field demonstration was begun in 2000. It was operated for about 18 months before the current operation was permitted. The San Francisco Bay Water Board typically approves these types of systems with permits called waste discharge requirements or site cleanup requirements, and these are California-specific permits that are issued under the state water code. They're considered analogous with RCRA or underground injection permits, which typically would be required in many other states. Sodium lactate was initially used for the pilot test, but then they later switched to propylene glycol, and this is based mainly on the laboratory tests and other site-specific advantages. One in particular is that the sodium lactate was crystallizing in the well, so it was creating a lot of clogging problems and reducing permeability. So currently we have batch injections that are done twice a week of propylene glycol into each of these 39 circulation wells. What you see, as you can see, the biobarrier is situated across the downgradient portion of the plume. Thus, the remedial goal of the system is primarily mass flux reduction from the source area and protection of downgradient receptors, such as the river and the lagoon to the north. And this is a containment orientation. It raises concerns about what to do about the downgradient portion of the plume that was, predates the installation of the biobarrier. Because of groundwater velocities at this site, they're fairly slow. It's anticipated to take several years before clean effluent that leaves the biobarrier zone can actually flush through this area and start to clean it up. And of course, there's going to have to be several pore volumes flowing through before we actually see noticeable results in the downgrading area. And I think that Scott alluded to this factor, that it takes lots of time before we actually see the cleanup in the downgradient zone. So if necessary, hydraulic containment or other options could be used for receptor protection, such as the lagoon or the river. Now, as Mike discussed earlier, the bio-rare replacement across this plume creates the problem of performance monitoring, because these wells start out being placed within a plume, so they have an ambient concentration or background concentration already of the contaminants, if you will. Slide 66. Now, this figure shows a conceptual model of how the biobarrier is monitored, both from a performance and a compliance point of view. When the system was first permitted, the focus was on performance wells to demonstrate that this could, in fact, work for the site. These were referred to as the effluent wells that I mentioned that are shown here in red. The goal of the performance monitoring is simply to quantify the contaminant breakdown that's occurring across the barrier. So it's basically about comparing the upgradient versus the downgradient concentrations immediately on either side of the barrier. The challenge for locating the performance monitoring wells, again, is that they're, you want them to be just beyond the influence of the circulation wells, so they're measuring the effluent as it's free-flowing on, under the natural gradient. But at the same time, you don't want them to be too far away that clean effluent then starts to mix again, remixes with the contaminant plume in the downgradient portion. So for this site, a distance of about 20 feet was chosen, and again, this was based mainly on the tracer tests and some of the pumping tests and the aquifer conditions. As with any bioremediation system, performance monitoring includes the parent and the daughter compounds, metabolic gases such as carbon dioxide, hydrogen, ethane, and methane, and also quantification of the microbes. So in a sense, there's three lines of evidence. Compliance monitoring wells are shown in blue. These wells are generally located more than about 100 feet down gradient. And the goal of these wells is to measure the long-term compliance in the downgradient aquifer in comparison with whatever water quality standards have been established for that zone. Eventually, as more clean effluent flows through, the downgradient should become cleaner. Again, at this site, we expect that's probably going to be on the 5 to 10 year range before we see any significant effects at this 100-foot distance. Slide 67. This slide is another view of the bioreactor approach. It illustrates how the system performance is actually calculated. Here you can see that you've got up gradient groundwater is captured. It's circulated within a three-well segment, and then eventually the effluent is measured at the downgradient effluent monitoring well. The system was initially designed and permitted with one effluent well for each circulation well, which is a fairly sparse monitoring network. Since things are not as homogeneous as they appear, because we're having some difficulty actually ensuring that there aren't any gaps, we're actually looking at increasing this the frequency of effluent monitoring wells to something on the order of perhaps 3 per segment. The performance concept is referred to as the destruction rate efficiency, or DRE, simply a comparison of inflow versus outflow concentrations. This method is useful because it allows for identifying specific locations along the entire length of the segment where you may not be having the best performance. So they can go in instead of, where do you start to tweak a system that is 1,000 feet long and 13 circulation wells? Well, you want to look at segment by segment, and over every three-well segment, if the performance doesn't look like it's up to the standard or the goal that has been set for that area, they can go in just to that segment and try to figure out what's going on. Slide 65. Now, here's a slide that shows kind of the overall system performance for a two-and-a-half-year period from 2001 to 2003. This was just at the beginning, after the demonstration project had been in operation for about 18 months. They went to what we permitted, and this is the initial results for that two-and-a-half-year period. It shows the average DRE for the entire site, all three biobarrier zones over a two-year period. What you can see is that there is a statistically significant trend, and initially it started out about 40%, and contaminant destruction to nearly 70% by the end of this monitoring period. As of March 2006, this trend is near about 90%. So it's an average of all 39 circulation wells, the destruction that's measured over all of those segments. Also, there's an estimated 27,000 pounds of VOC mass destruction. Now, of course, the larger question is really whether or not this destruction rate is good enough for various purposes. First of all, to achieve water quality goals, or groundwater protection, or the risk reduction that may be needed for a receptor protection, and whether or not it can do that in a reasonable time frame. So at the moment, the jury is still out. We're reviewing the latest performance to try to see what tweaks we can make. It's encouraging that we're getting destruction, but we still haven't answered the question if it's good enough to reach a low MCL, for example, if that were set as the water quality standard. Slide 69. There are several regulatory issues associated with this type of biobarrier system, not the least of which is the addition of amendment chemicals to an aquifer. A lot of regulatory agencies are concerned of this. For example, could those amendments create toxic byproducts? Could they cause mobilization of metals or other mineral or aquifer constituents? Could nearby surface waters be affected by the addition of the amendments? To address these concerns, we certainly required laboratory testing, bench scale testing, tracer testing, and then the field demonstration project. The demonstration was that within less than 100 feet of the biobarrier, we weren't seeing any indicators of escaping amendments. Another concern is that the biobarrier takes a finite amount of time to establish the treatment zone. It doesn't happen instantaneously like when you add the iron in a PRB. So how much time should be allowed to demonstrate the results? It's a big question, and I think the answer is highly depends on the regulatory agency involved. Related to this issue is how to verify exactly where the bioremediation zone is located. Are there gaps? How far down gradient does it extend? And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, there are performance issues with placing the biobarrier across the plume, which make it difficult to evaluate the performance and the ultimate compliance. Slide 70. There are also significant operation and maintenance challenges with the biobarriers, particularly those that use amendment injection or circulation, such as this case example. For example, how often do you need to add amendments, and where and how will they be stored? For this site, amendment addition occurs biweekly for each of the 39 circulation wells. So this is essentially a full-time job for a technician to be out there at that site doing that. The injection and circulation wells also need periodic cleaning and maintenance. There have been at least a couple of instances where they've had to go through and essentially clean all 39 circulation wells. So it's a fair effort. At the site, the O&M costs are on the order of $1 to $2 million per year, which is a lot of money. But when you compare this, they did the initial comparison to a pump and treat system that would be needed to essentially keep the plume from discharging to the surface water bodies, and these costs still came out favorable. One very interesting footnote about this project is that it was one of a few projects that the ITRC used to help persuade EPA to clarify its position on the issue of reinjecting contaminated groundwater that contain RCRA hazardous waste. So if you're interested, I'm not going to go into it, but if you're interested, you'll find a summary of this issue within the notes. I believe it's on slide 69. You can take a look at that. Slide 71. So in summary, the biobarriers function similar to other PRBs, although they rely on secondary treatment processes. The significant regulatory concerns exist, particularly if you're doing injection or circulation. And these include the O&M costs, the high degree of operation and maintenance that's required. So it's something that you need to look at during the design and be aware of so you can compare it to other methods in the feasibility study. And lastly, the monitoring program and network are the keys to demonstrating successful performance and compliance. And I think with a lot of these systems, we think of a monitoring program that goes in initially and then never gets tweaked or touched. But this is an example where it's essentially adaptive management. We're looking to see the gaps in the biobarrier. It's not static. They change. So the monitoring program is changing over the years. We're constantly adding new wells and tweaking the monitoring a little bit. So with that, I'd like to turn the show over to Dave Smith, and we'll gladly take any questions at the end.
Thanks, Alec. I'm going to spend the next few minutes talking about a demonstration early solid phase thermal reactive barrier to treat metals and sulfate-rich groundwater associated with acid mine drainage. As Alec mentioned, it's one of the possibilities. It's a solid phase organic carbon amendment, really, to a trench-type excavation. The barrier was installed at a mine site in Sudbury, Ontario, in 1995. This particular section, or this particular application, is pertinent to section 256 in the main report, which deals primarily with organic carbon media for sulfate reduction, denitrification, and perchlorate treatment. And this particular site study is also described in Appendix E of the report, case study 34. In slide 73, the acid mine drainage situation is summarized in a schematic form. Sulfide oxidation of the mine waste generates iron-rich and sulfate-rich water and low pH water as well. And there's often other metals and metalloids associated with the primarily the iron in the original sulfide mineralogy. Some of this water can leave as surface discharge. A lot of it actually moves through groundwater, the groundwater system. And upon discharge to a stream or lake, a second oxidation reaction occurs, and that's iron, ferrous iron being converted to ferric iron with the addition of oxygen. And this also tends to release hydrogen ions and affect pH further. This pH reduction in surface waters is often a key constituent associated with metal mobility in the acid mine drainage settings. So the purpose for the permoreactive barrier is to try and intercept this groundwater flow path of iron and sulfate-rich water. And again, we use solid phase organic carbon, and our objective is to add a simple organic carbon material, CH2O, to provide an energy source for sulfate-reducing bacteria. And then we look for the metals to combine with hydrogen sulfide and precipitate out as a solid phase sulfide. In slide 74, again, our objectives are relatively straightforward. We remove sulfate and iron. By removing iron, we reduce the acid generating potential of the groundwater. And in the iron removal mechanism, sulfate precipitate, we also look to remove other metals and metalloids. Arsenic, nickel, things like that are commonly taken out of solution in the sulfide form. And we also, in this process, generate alkalinity, which helps further in the pH control associated with these sites. The sulfate reduction process, again, it's microbially mediated on slide 75. Carbon provides energy to the bacteria. Sulfate is reduced to hydrogen sulfide, and then hydrogen sulfide combines with the metals and metalloids. And again, this has the benefit of increasing pH and providing alkalinity to the system. The Nickel Rim Mine in Sudbury, Ontario, slide 76. An acid mine drainage situation. A tailings area was used from the 50s to the early 1970s. And a plume of impacted water had developed through departing the tailings area through a bedrock valley. The pH of the groundwater away from the tailings was approximately 6, although much lower in the tailings themselves or in parts of the tailings themselves. The sulfate concentrations in the groundwater in the aquifer ranged the time of the PRB installation in 1995 between about 1,000 and 3,000, but the concentration of sulfate actually is increasing with time, and so concentrations now in the plume are approaching 7,000 milligrams per liter sulfate. Iron concentrations at the time of PRB installation were in the range of 500 to 1,000 milligrams per liter, and again, these concentrations are increasing with time as the plume advances from the tailing area. The water table at this site is very close to ground surface. It's almost at ground surface for a portion of the year. It's in the Sudbury area, so the groundwater temperature fluctuates seasonally. Temperatures range from about 2 degrees centigrade in the late winter and early spring when initial spring water recharge occurs, and gets to about 15 degrees centigrade in the late summer and fall. And there is tailings impacted material embedded in the aquifer sediments on the surface, and so that makes interpretation and treatment a little more complex. In on slide 77, a little site map. So our tailings wastes are down in the lower right corner. Groundwater flow moving through a bedrock valley to a receiving lake, Moose Lake, about 100 meters from the tailings area. And the PRB system is installed about mid-distant from the tailings area to the receiving water. This leaves a big plume down gradient of the PRB, and certainly an issue to look at in terms of interpreting results, and also the selection of where we would actually put a PRB if we were actually moving towards closeout at this site. In slide 77, a brief summary of the PRB that was installed. It was installed in an open backfill trench. The reactive materials consisted of organic carbon materials, 40% municipal plant compost, 40% leaf mulch, and the remainder wood chips with a little bit of agricultural limestone added. And this reactive mixture was combined in a one-to-one mixture with gravel for actual placement in the ground. The PRB was not very large by many standards. It was 15 meters long, so that extended across the entire bedrock valley. It had a maximum depth of a little less than 4 meters and was about 8 meters in thick, including two sand zones on the upgradient and downgradient faces of the PRB. The cost was less than $40,000 in 1995. The next slide 79, shows the installation in progress. Again, just an open excavation. You can see the PRB installation in progress, upgradient and downgradient zones of sand, and that black zone where the bucket is the mixture of organic carbon material and gravel, 50-50. And you can also see the discoloration of the aquifer sediments, a lot of iron oxide type compounds associated with the original acid mine drainage transport and interaction with the ferrous iron with oxygenated water near ground surface, and in fact oxygen at surface as well. Slide 80 is just a closer up picture of the primitive reactive barrier system. And again, you can see the sand and the two sand zones upgrading and downgrading of the reactive materials. In slide 81, it shows the placement of the clay cap. The clay cap was put on top of the permo-reactive barrier system because the water table is so close to ground surface for a couple of reasons. One was to minimize the direct influx of precipitation and runoff water into the permo-reactive barrier system. And also the clay cap, as the moisture content built up, became a bit of an oxygen transport barrier. And sulfate reduction is an anaerobic process, so we want to really minimize the influx of oxygen to that treatment system. Slide 82 shows groundwater monitoring results within the first year of following installation. In the middle diagram, you can see that chloride is starting to be flushed out of the permoreactive barrier. Chloride was associated with the organic carbon material, isn't really present in the aquifer system, and you can just see that the chloride is starting to be flushed out. A year after installation, in June of 1996, you can see a significant advance of the chloride downgrading of the permoreactive barrier system, and in fact a chloride-free zone of groundwater coming in behind it. This served to be a bit of a tracer test and indicated that groundwater velocity in the vicinity of the barrier was about 16 meters per year. And the residence time of water in the barrier ranged from a minimum of 60 days or so to a little bit more than that. So residence time of water in the barrier was something of the order of 60 days. In slide 83, the treatment results from year one, sulfate entering the barrier at concentrations of more than 2,000 milligrams per liter, and significant removal of sulfate more than 1,000 to approaching 2,000 milligrams per liter in parts of the barrier system. Iron concentrations decreased from more than 350 milligrams per liter to less than 50 milligrams per liter. And because the iron was being taken out, the acid-generating potential was significantly decreased. In slide 84, treatment results from year 6 for sulfate. Again, increasing concentrations of sulfate in the entering the barrier. And again, continued removal of between 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams per liter sulfate in the PRB system. Slide 85 shows iron treatment results after 6 years of operation. And again, removal of several hundred milligrams per liter iron in the reactive barrier system. The evidence for sulfate reduction in the permeable reactive barrier is generated by several trends. The first that we looked at in our monitoring results is the fate of sulfate, and it appears that the barrier system removes in excess of 1,000 milligrams per liter of sulfate as it moves through the barrier system, both in the initial year of operation and more than 6 years after installation. So we know sulfate's decreasing, but to make sure that it's not just sorption or something like that, sulfate-reducing bacteria, their populations are much more prolific in the barrier system than either upgradient or downgradient. We definitely monitored dissolved sulfide in the groundwater, and so with that presence, we're quite confident that some of the sulfate is being converted to hydrogen sulfide. There's isotopic enrichment in the remnant sulfate in the groundwater within and down gradient of the barrier. And what that means is that what this indicates, the heavier isotope of sulfur 34 is preferentially left in solution, and the lighter sulfur 32 is actually used by the bacteria in the sulfate reduction process. Iron monosulfites have actually been identified in solid phase cores within the barrier system on several occasions, and the rate of accumulation of these iron monosulfites has been used to indicate that the level of activity has not decreased significantly at the time of most recent monitoring. It was an 84 month monitoring period, and basically what the monitoring suggested was about 1,000 millimoles per gram per year of sulfide mineralogy was being formed within the barrier in the 1995 to 1997 period, and there was a very slight decrease then in the for the same sort of coring initiatives over in the period 1997 to 2001. So in summary, the reactive wall has removed a very significant portion of the dissolved iron from the plume and has severely decreased the acid generating potential of that plume. In addition to iron, approximately 15 milligrams per liter nickel has been removed from the groundwater. So nickel is almost fully removed, and iron concentrations have been very significantly decreased. This removal of iron and precipitation as an iron sulfide has reduced the acid-generating potential of the groundwater and is certainly making the down-gradient groundwater system more favorable than the up-gradient. Heterogeneity is definitely an issue. The higher groundwater flow velocity in the central portion of the barrier, it generates a higher contaminant load, and organic carbon is being preferentially removed from that central portion of the barrier relative to other parts of the barrier. The carbon source that was used at the nickel rim barrier proved to be quite effective. It provided slow-release carbon compounds for sulfate-reducing bacteria for an extended period of time. And it probably is something in an 10 to 11 year time frame that treatment now will start getting a more significant breakthrough of the plume in that at that site. Even in the shallow groundwater Canadian winter context, sulfate reduction continues to occur even though there is a cold temperature impact on the barrier system. So although there's difficulties interpreting treatment down gradient because there's a big flush zone between the thermoactive barrier system and the receiving lake, there is strong evidence that significant groundwater contaminant attenuation was achieved by this barrier system. Again, it was only $35,000 worth of materials that was installed in the ground in 1995. If a larger barrier system had been installed, possibly closer to the lake, we could have done a far more complete job at treatment and acid mine drainage attenuation. So that sums up my site demonstration. In the final slide, just for the overall summary conclusions of today's presentation, slide 83. We know that, slide 88, we know that the benefits for complete and accurate site characterization is necessary prior to design and installation of a PRB system. In our discussions, you've heard reference to things like hydraulic performance, hydraulic characterization, things like groundwater flow directions and groundwater velocities. They're all key to optimizing the alignment, thickness of the reactive barrier system, that sort of thing, and also quite important in coming to grips with interpretation of how the barrier system is performing. There's also other lines of assessment, though, that are required, the full suite geochemistry before we start putting reactive materials in the ground, and also microbiological activity is very important, even for zero-valent iron barriers on their own. Our experience has grown significantly over the last 15 years or so. There's now more than 200 PRBs that have been deployed at a range of sites, primarily in North America, but also in other parts of the world as well. Based on today's presentations, we've also heard that there's reactive materials in addition to zero-valent iron that can be quite effective for removing certain types of contaminants, zeolites for absorptive barrier for radionuclides and some of the other inorganic contaminants, carbon sources for sulfate reduction and biobarriers, and also other materials such as phosphate materials are being used for metals control as well. And again, PRBs, they are certainly a capital cost. They have a capital cost associated with their installation, but they can be cost effective due to their passive to semi-passive mode of operation. And so in many settings, they can be quite cost effective in relation to other remedial or remedial control technologies. And with that, I'd like to end today's presentation and open the floor to questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Dave. This is Juliana. If anyone would turn to slide 89, before we do go to those questions, let's look at the links to additional resources. If you click on the links to additional resources area on this slide, it'll take you to the links for today's training. In section one is some archives of internet-based trainings. Our instructors have referred to the previous PRB team products, and they're available in section one and section two of the links page. We also have additional links that you may find useful. If you scroll back up to the top and look to the left, we have a link for our feedback, and we ask that you fill out the feedback form before you leave the site today. Let us know what you thought of today's presentation. I will now open the floor for questions. If you've muted your phone, please unmute it. It is *7 if you used our system. Please state your name and location when asking your question. Do we have questions from our phone line audience?
William Stewart from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. The granular iron in the permeable barriers, what would be the effective size, the importance of the effective size of the granular iron used in the trenches?
This is Mike Duchesne. The most common iron that's been used, and it's been shown to work well, is a minus 8 to 50 U.S. mesh size. So it's about a 2-millimeter particle down to about a 0.25-millimeter particle. And the hydraulic conductivity is somewhere around 5 times 10 to the minus 2 centimeters per second for that material.
Thank you.
This is Juliana from our simulcast audience. Rita Dolan from Greenwood Environmental Consulting in Illinois asks, how deep have the barriers been installed? Are there more significant construction issues with deeper barriers?
This is Mike Duchesne. The deepest one that I know that's been excavated has been about 70 feet deep, and that was with the biopolymer slurry excavation method. And then there's a vertical hydrofracking method that's been used, and they've gone down as deep as about 130 feet, but they certainly could go deeper than that. It's an injection-based method, so you drill a borehole and then create the PRB out of the borehole. So obviously with excavation, there's trench support issues, and that's why 70, 80 feet is about the maximum you can go when you excavate. But then as soon as you switch into these injection-type methods, then you can go to greater depths than that.
Thank you. Another simulcast from Tim Frasher at Boeing in Kansas. To conduct the most meaningful pilot study, how do you determine the minimum length of the PRB for your pilot test?
Yeah, I guess what you got to look at is you want to make sure you're not getting flow around your PRB, and also if you have any change in groundwater flow direction, that you got a long enough PRB to monitor it. But you know, having said that, 3 to 4 meters long, most sites should be long enough to get a good idea of what the flow, to get flow through the PRB and treatment at the size of the PRB. And the other thing comes back to is also your construction method. If you're going to excavate to any depths, you need a certain width of excavation or length of your PRB just so that you physically excavate the PRB.
Thank you. Do we have additional questions from our phone line audience?
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
This is Jeff Alvick from Jake's Whitford Company in Pennsylvania. We're designing a permeable reactive barrier with a flow-through window through a slurry wall. And our upgradient groundwater is very low pH, mainly it's from peat-derived sediments. And we're wondering what type of common method would it be to increase the pH as it enters the treatment window.
This is Dave Smith here. I guess one of the issues with pH neutralization barriers, if you put in something like calcium carbonate in a solid phase form, there's an armoring reaction that takes place. Initially, you get quite good neutralization reactions occurring, and then coatings forming on the grains that diminish that neutralization, really access of the water to the reactive material with time. And so things like limestone drains for acid mine drainage function quite well in the short term, and then their performance diminishes. The one advantage with something like a sulfate reduction barrier, and I'm not sure if your water chemistry is suitable for this, is that the biological activity actually, by reducing sulfate to sulfide, that geochemical reaction actually releases alkalinity to the water, and so your pH is neutralized by a sustainable by a geochemical reaction as opposed to a straight physical chemical reaction, and it may be slightly more sustainable in the long term to have that continue to perform.
Would you suggest something like a Flomag filter with a liquid?
I would I mean, I'm not sure how, what sort of flow rates you're dealing with, but you might look at a solid phase material that releases organic carbon on a kind of a slow release type approach, and something like a hardwood sawdust wood chip type mixture might achieve that for you. So it would be a solid phase kind of fixed bed reactor type material.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
This is Juliana with another simulcast question. Stan Stinger with the state of Wisconsin asked, has PRB technology been used on pesticide sites? If so, do you know what active ingredient was involved and the state agency that was involved?
This is Mike Duchesne. Some of the pesticides will go with granular iron, and off the top of my head, I can't think of any sites that have actually gone ahead. There's been a bunch of laboratory-type work done for that. And then there's also another product out there that combines granular iron with a solid phase organic carbon, and it's been used quite a bit to treat pesticides in soils, and there's reason to believe that that same technology can be used in a PRB-type configuration to treat pesticides in groundwater. But, yeah, to answer your question, I don't know of any off the top of my head where they've actually installed a PRB for pesticides.
One of the issues is pesticides. It's a big class of compounds, and some go aerobically, some go anaerobically. So it's hard to make a blanket statement that applies to all.
Thank you. And another simulcast, this is from Mary Rose Casa at the California Regional Water Quality Control Board. She refers to slide 50 and asks, what caused the water gradient direction to be characterized incorrectly?
I think, let's see here, let me go back to 50. I think that was the West Valley site, is that right? Well, I think the biggest aspect, this is Scott Warner answering that, Mary Rose, hi. I think the biggest aspect of that is that there were not enough wells initially. All the wells that are shown on that slide, many of them actually came later after they installed the pilot system. And so what we found is that we installed some additional wells and got a better feel for what the groundwater gradient was. And also the wells were not necessarily, because of the heterogeneity in the stratigraphy, were not necessarily measuring the same hydraulic system. In other words, there were screens of various lengths. So I think that just shows that, you don't want to certainly overdo it, but you do need, the three wells to give you a gradient that's great on paper, but it's not necessarily appropriate for a fairly complex system. And I think that's pretty much what happens with that one.
Thank you. Do we have additional questions from our phone line audience? Another question from our simulcast audience, from Daniel Susani in Italy. Can a high sulfate content affect the reactions within an iron PRB application?
Dave Smith here. Sulfate reduction can actually occur within an iron, within a straight zero-valent iron barrier. At the Elizabeth City barrier that was installed in 1996, there's relatively low sulfate concentrations in that influent groundwater, but we're talking concentrations that range from less than 10 to possibly several tens of milligrams per liter. And clearly iron sulfate compounds and, in fact, sulfide in the water, hydrogen sulfide in the water has been detected in monitoring there. So sulfate reduction is occurring, probably microbially mediated, within that zero-valent iron barrier, although it wasn't installed with that in mind. So the subsurface biological community certainly can survive in zero-valent iron, and so can start to function. The amount of sulfide, solid phase sulfide minerals that might form in a case like Elizabeth City wouldn't be expected to be very much, and would be far less than the carbonates and things like that that are forming in that barrier. And so their effect on hydraulic characteristics and reactivity would be relatively modest.
Thank you. Another simulcast question, this from Aaron Staniewski at GeoInsight in New Hampshire. Have Dave or Alex seen or been involved in a site where a series of injection wells were used to introduce a carbon amendment, like wood chips, eliminating the construction of the wall? In theory, the leaching of the organic carbon forming the radius of influence around the well.
This is Alec. Are you referring to, is the question referring to an injection of a solid amendment, like wood chips? Or certainly, I'm aware of many sites that have used an injection of liquid amendments to do just that, but not any that are using, somehow replacing a solid material through.
This is Dave Smith here. One of the difficulties with a solid phase material for a sulfate reduction barrier is you need residence time. The amount of, if I look back at the nickel rim site, there's a 60-day residence time and removing between 1,000 and 2,000 milligrams per liter sulfate means that our reaction is occurring. We're removing about 15 to 30 milligrams per liter sulfate per day. And that's in full contact with the organic carbon material. And so when you have kind of flow gaps between that material in a kind of a passive well type construction system, it's hard to generate residence time in contact with organic carbon material or sufficiently high organic carbon concentrations in the groundwater to achieve the level of treatment that might be desired.
Thank you. We are out of time for today's class. We will follow up on the remaining simulcast questions. I would like to thank our participants today and give a special thanks to our instructors for providing today's training class. As a reminder, please fill out the feedback form before you finish up for today. You're also welcome to visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org for more information about ITRCs and for the PRB resources that are available on the website. Thank you again for attending, and have a great day.